Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast. My name is Stuart Horsfield and we are here with These Football Times. And tonight I'm delighted to welcome another author to the centre circle. However, before we introduce this edition's author, I would like to introduce the two usual wingmen that are coming to me on such journeys. So first of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you?
We're doing well, Stu, we're doing well.
You're sounding better, I've got to say. I'm guessing that man flu's gone.
Yeah, not quite gone, but it's gone enough to stop complaining about it.
Okay, all right. And then we go across the Mediterranean to Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you, sir?
How are you doing, buddy? Well, I think Stu might have passed the man flu over here. The wife's got it at the moment, so it's a woman flu there. I just hope it doesn't graduate to me, so... We'll see, but aside from that, I've got a light glass of Crianza here, so I'm okay, buddy.
The baton has been passed.
Well done, Stephen. Excellent work by you. And so on to tonight's guest. Now, tonight's guest is going to require quite a long introduction, and when I've gone through it, you'll fully understand why, and certainly it is fully deserving. Tonight is going to be an absolutely fascinating discussion and chat with this man. So... tonight's guest in the centre circle is Mr. Justin Whalley. Justin, truly a citizen of the world. Many of his travels have been related to football and admits that to date has attended 6 World Cups, 6 European Championships, 2 Copa Americas, lived in 8 countries, visited 125 countries, was involved in founding of Riga United in 2007, Europe's most cosmopolitan national league amateur football club, and in 2013 helped form the Riga United Youth Academy and took the team to the Latvian National League the following year. He created Riga Ladies United and 2 years later won the Latvian Premier League bronze medal. Until October 2016, he worked on the development of Riga United Football Club in Latvia. In February 2017, became the Africa Director for CONIFA. A week later, Justin also joined Tackle Africa as one of their volunteer coaches. And for the 2017 season, he coached Latvian second league team FK Allianz. As if that wasn't enough, and certainly by no means the full extent of his experiences, until August 2018, he was the head coach of Matabeleland, the only team from Southern Africa competing at the CONIFA World Football Cup in 2018. Now, in order to get the team there, as well as coaching, Pelt raised $30,000, managed to get the team featured on a variety of networks, including CNN, BBC World Service, Deutsche Welle, AFP, NHK Japan. Also, Stephen will like this, persuaded goalkeeper legend Bruce Grobbelaar to join the team as his goalkeeper coach and brand ambassador. Matabeleland finished the World Cup with a record 3 wins, 1 draw, 2 defeats, including beating a recognised country. Matabeleland gained recognition all over the world for the way the team conducted itself. But simply put, without the efforts of our guest, Mr. Justin Whalley, none of that would have happened. And in his book, One Football, No Nets, it just relates the most extraordinary tale of how an English football coach became the driving force of an African footballing miracle. Justin, welcome to the Lob podcast.
Thank you very much. That was some intro. Thank you.
No, all deserved. Like I say, it's fantastic. It's an incredible story. And certainly, you know, sort of for the next hour or so, I can't wait. My job on here is great. All I get to do is just ask a few questions, prod and poke a few people and sit back and see what happens. But this is going to be brilliant. So what we'll do is we'll sort of divide the chat up into the four sections, if that's okay with you. Obviously, that's Stephen cool. And Gary are just going to chip in with questions, and sometimes we'll go off on tangents. Feel free to go off on tangents. This is just a chat about probably the most incredible football story we've ever had on here. So, Stephen, Gary, are you ready?
Yeah, ready for all, mate.
All right. So, Justin, first of all, then, a little bit about yourself. So, your own footballing history. You know, who do you support? What led you to fall in love with the game? That sort of thing. Before we get onto your extraordinary journey, just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, my football history, I suppose my first love of the game came from my granddad taking me down to Northampton Town. It sounds unlikely, doesn't it, that that's where the love of the game would come from. But he took me down there as a little boy. I was probably about 6 years old. And I just remember seeing the footlights down there at the county ground and just being absolutely fascinated by that whole environment. And same time as that, I just started kicking a ball around at school. Got put in a school team, and then, you know, that 40-year love affair with the game started at that point.
Is it? I mean, obviously the book, and as we go through it, you know, you visit 125 countries. There's going to be a lot of travel involved. Your first love, is it football, or is it your desire to travel and see the world? Which is the stronger passion in your life?
In all honesty, the travel is the bigger passion for me. Because I've constantly got that desire there that I want to go and explore new places and have new adventures. I absolutely love football. I mean, you know, I watch it every day. I play it whenever I can. But you know, I can pass if there's a game on. I can pass on that. But the actual travel itself, you know, there's just a world of opportunities and adventures out there, and There's an addiction there that I can't seem to shake off.
I mean, Gary, you know, you Steve and I, you know, we've all read the book, you know, we've all read this incredible tale, and again, obviously with the introduction, but it shows again, doesn't it, that football, you know, a Northampton Town fan, no disrespect, Justin, I apologise to you and all Northampton Town fans, but like we said, it, you know, when you read the book, you don't imagine that it all started away back sort of at Northampton Town with a, you know, with a youngster going to watch football, do you?
Dead right, mate. I mean, you know, anybody who reads this book, and I will recommend anybody who likes football to read this book. It's a fantastic story, and it's true. You know, I mean, it's you couldn't make it up. It's so anybody who is interested in football, I recommend to read this book. And my sort of love of football began in a not too dissimilar way. I lived in Walsall, and my dad just took me to watch Walsall play, so not too different to Northampton Town. But, you know, just one of the sort of things I was going to ask you, Justin, is the book is just so detailed. There's so many things went on. And obviously you kept diaries. Was it always in your mind to write a book?
I love writing. And one of the things I've done travelling in the last few years is I've always kept travel diaries, just for my own state of mind and remembering stuff. There's so many small details that we forget, so it's just great to write them down. And I also find it quite a therapeutic exercise for myself. So going out to Zimbabwe, I felt I had to write a diary. I had to. And not just to keep a record of it, but just sometimes when you feel like you're going a bit mad with it, with events, you sit there and you write them down and you reflect a little bit about what's going on. So the diary was something I would have done anyway, but as things got increasingly more surreal or extreme, shall we say, I think I appreciated that there was a story that could be told, deserve to be told, perhaps later on.
Yeah, I guess that comes through very much in the book. Another thing is, I was going to say that you know, although it's a football book, I think it's also a lot about people, and almost like football is the backdrop for all these people that you've met and the sort of the things that you've achieved and together with these people. And you know, some of the stories, you know, especially from Matabeleland, of the people you met there, you know, truly amazing. I mean, are we sort of conscious to sort of tell the story of people as well as the football?
Yeah, well, because, you know, when I kept the diary, you tend to write down your events from the day and what went on. And I did keep a record of all my coaching sessions, and I had to do that. That was my way of planning for what was going on with the team. But you know, when it came to putting the book together, there were so many, I suppose, interesting anecdotes and, you know, a picture on what life was like in Zimbabwe at a tumultuous time, that To some extent, some of the football took a bit of a back seat. I mean, there's obviously lots of football in there in Zimbabwe, but I thought it was also important to tell the tale of how things were, you know, with the Robert Mugabe's final days and all the things connected to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen, we talked. This is awful. I can't remember the author's name. How bad am I? Stanley Back Home a couple of weeks ago.
Jeff.
And we talked then, didn't we, about, you know, football and social life and social observation, and football is rich for this sort of a story, isn't it, that Justin sort of recounted for us.
Oh, it is. I mean, I think that you can probably draw a few parallels with it. Whereas we spoke to Jeff a couple of weeks ago about that crossing the streams of kind of football fact with a fictional storyline to go through it. You know, this book of Justin's, which is a remarkable piece of work, is, you know, it's a travel book that just takes in football along with it for the ride, basically. You know, I don't tend to steer too far away from football literature as far as my reading goes, but when I do, it tends to be travel, you know, and so it's made it kind of like a perfect kind of book for me, and it works perfectly as well, you know, and that's the great thing about it. For me, I'd read this book whatever the, you know, the added topic and thread through it was, because it's just a fantastic book.
So obviously, you know, in the introduction, Justin, you know, we had an awful lot about an awful lot of things that you've done, but I suppose if we start with Latvia now, it's not a what I would say a traditional hotbed of European football. So, you know, there, how did you get started there? What took you there? What was the initial steps that you took to become involved in football in Latvia?
Well, it had absolutely nothing to do with football, me going to Latvia. It goes back a long way. It goes back to, ironically, a time when I tried to get a serious involvement in football in England. I'd worked at Euro 96 at the city of Nottingham, and I was doing my coaching badges at the time. I had an interview with Tottenham Hotspur to work with them off the pitch as well. And none of it quite worked out how I intended. So I ended up going travelling around the world with a good mate of mine. And we went away for more than a year, travelled to 35 countries. And that was completely life-changing, to the extent where one of the places that we visited was Latvia during that trip. And, you know, the Baltic states at that time, we talk about 97, 98, it was just a different world. You know, the internet was only really taking off, so it was a bit closed to most people. They didn't know even the place existed. And both myself and my friend really fell in love with the Baltic states, and particularly with the city of Riga. And my mate Kelvin, he moved over there, and I ended up after I was travelling. I was in Bristol for a while, and I just by coincidence I had a job that kept taking me out in tourism. I kept going out to the Baltics, and I just had this feeling I had to move. I had to move out to Latvia. Yeah. And give it a go. And if you ask me why, it was you know, obviously nothing to do with football. It was to do with a beautiful city, pretty girls, exciting nightlife. Being somewhere that just gave myself and my friend there just gave us a real buzz. And it was very affordable. We went there and we had. I went there and I had very little money, but I could live relatively like a king at the time, and that's what took me there initially. It was a place where I just fancied living, really. But then the football side of things, it was really I wasn't in any fit state to play in those days because I was partying too much, to be honest with you. A little bit of football. I ended up teaching English out there, and one lad at the school, we often talked about, we often complained that there was nowhere for us to play football. So we just said, let's just hire a, you know, let's hire a court, sports court ball out and five-a-side kick about. And, you know, you fast forward a few years and out of that, essentially came Riga United in many ways. It was a project that eventually, you know, that was created out of just a load of mates joining together to play five-a-side.
Wow. Yeah, I'm just jumping in here. It's amazing. Lots of people travel all over the world. I mean, I've moved to Spain, and you know that's a big enough thing anyway. But to then decide I'm going to form a football club. I mean, it's a massive thing, you know. But I guess it all depends how you approach these things. But for so many people, you know, that would seem a massive project to undertake. And it's, I suppose it's just sort of redolent of the rest of the story as we go along. But I mean, I hear what you're saying about your few friends playing football and five-a-side. But how difficult was it to establish a football club in a foreign country? I mean, it must be difficult enough in England.
Well, as I said, in the early days, it was nothing much more than a kickabout. I was going to mention around those early days, I actually played with Gary Johnson, if you know, the ex Bristol City manager. Yeah. He used to be the Latvian manager. So we had a couple of kickabouts back in the early 2000s while Gary was the manager of the national team. But the team, it was nothing serious till, I guess, you know, 2006. We just started really having our first proper 11-a-side team and playing touring teams, you know, you could almost call them pub sides that came over for long weekends. You know, Latvia had just joined the European Union. So you suddenly got the Ryanair flights and stuff. And yeah, these teams had come out and they'd start, they wanted to play football on the weekend. And we had that contact with them. And a mate of ours had a business. And so he sort of sold them hotels and different things as well. So we had that relationship. It used to work very well because we then show all the lads around the city and they'd be safe, you know, and they get to see some of the best places. So that worked really well. And then what happened was with the EU thing for Latvia, we just started to get lots of foreigners living in here. So the lads who were coming down to training, it just got steadily higher and higher standard of player. And you suddenly realised that you could have quite a decent team. So then we said, look, you know, let's make this. We started the name Riga United. We designed a kit, a badge, all those basic things. The lads paid, you know, regular money to train. And then it was, yeah, we just played in sort of eight-a-side leagues, that kind of thing. But it wasn't really until back end of 2011, early 2012, that we just said, let's make this more serious. Let's try and take this to the National League. So we went to the Latvian Football Federation and said, what do we do? We want to put this team in the National League setup. And they said, yeah, there's a great long list of things you have to do. And your club has to be a registered charity, or it has to be a proper sports club and all these things. And you have to register all your players and all the things you'd expect. And we just started working on that and getting the lads. We then started, you know, training three times a week because that's what we felt it required. We had a lad, Jeffrey Young, he was a UEFA B licensed, who worked in Holland in the US, and he came in and started running the training for us. And I assisted Jeff, and we had a few other lads who had been around for a few years. And, you know, before you know it, the team was ready to compete in the third tier, which was, crazy when you remember where we were at a few years earlier.
That, I mean, again, Steve, you know, these are incredible stories. I know we keep coming back to it, but it's, like we say, this ability that football almost has to just transcend any sort of situation, any problem, any language barriers, any ills with the world. Obviously, Gary and I, you know, Gary's political football season, you know, we've talked there about the impact it can have on countries. But I mean, you know, Stephen, it's, you know, it is incredible, isn't it, how bridges can be built or problems can be overcome just with, you know, a simple game.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about it. You know, it's a language all of its own. you know, it brings, you know, people together. You know, it's a round ball. Everyone understands it. It's brilliant. I'm fascinated by the Latvia years in particular. I'd love to know just what difference Euro 2004 made to the country when Latvia qualified for the tournament.
It changed it in football terms, because football was really way behind ice hockey and basketball and motor racing and all the winter sports like the bobsleigh. And that was an incredible team. I mean, that came out of Skonto Riga, where they'd won, you know, more than a dozen National League titles on the spin, I think it was. And almost the entire national team came out of Skonto and beat Turkey away in the playoffs and went to Portugal. And they drew, of course, they drew with Germany, didn't they?
Yeah, it was like Czech Republic, Germany, and the Netherlands, and they led against the Czech Republic, got a draw against Germany. It was only against the Netherlands that they were undone, you know. And I think for me, they were one of the great stories of the tournament, and the fact that they peaked like that and they've never been back since to a major tournament. And yeah, I was just wondering what ball that set rolling, you know.
It was that very good team, and they kept those lads together, and a lot of very good footballers. It's almost, if you imagine a kind of Forest in the 78, and if you could have held on to a team like that for 10 years, imagine what, you know, you could have had a national team coming out of something like that. It was a bit like that, really, and it was fantastic, because I was on the terraces in Portugal. I went and supported England and Latvia. I think it's the only time I'll ever go and support two national teams in a tournament. For the Germany game, just remember we had there was a few thousand behind the goal there that travelled over from Latvia, you know, a country of 2 million, and they had a few thousand there that game out singing the German fans, and it was unbelievable. Yeah, of course the crowds for the national team after that, most games were pretty much sold out, or they football suddenly it took off, and there was lots of youth football that came out of it. But sadly, you know, I think football's gone backwards in many ways since then. And, I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's a sort of a peak, and it's going backwards ever since, really.
Just can I just ask a quick question there before we move on from Latvia? Riga United, Chris, then, you know, as if that wasn't difficult enough, you then formed a women's team as well there, didn't you? A women's team?
Yeah. That's what happened there. Yeah, I just had a Norwegian lady called Marit, who she just managed to get hold of my contact details and on Facebook, I think it was, and messaged me and said, I'm looking for a women's football club. I'm a foreign medical student. I've just come over from Norway, and I'd love to play football. Do you have a team? And I said, no. So we have. She said, can you sort of recommend any? And I was thinking, well, I don't really know anything about women's football in Latvia. So I started looking around, trying to help Marit out. And then I noticed there were only a few clubs that were serious. And I just said to Marit, what do you think if we had a training session? Could you get a load of girls down from your new uni to come down and play? I said, you know, I'm assuming some of the Scandinavian girls can play a bit. She said, yeah, I'll get them down. I said, well, let's do it a week on Wednesday. You try and get a load of girls down. I know a couple of Latvian girls who are friends of mine, and they said they've wanted a club, but they're not good enough to play for the top three or four clubs. So we held a training session, open training session. I think we had about 18 girls came down, and I was just on the back at how good some of them were. Some of the Scandinavian girls were just unbelievable. I mean, technically, you could argue they were better than a lot of our men. And I said to him, yeah, look, let's do it again. Let's do this the next couple of same time as we have the men's training. Let's see how many people turn up. And it was a little bit of a dip, but I think we sort of had 13 or 14 girls every week. And I said, do you want to go for it? Do you want to start a team? And the girls said yes. So I went to the Latvian Football Federation, and I met the head of the women's football, Nina, there. And she was very enthusiastic and said, too late for this season, but what we can do is we can enter you in the cup. So we founded the ladies team, and we entered the cup. We had a bye with the way it worked out with the number of entrants in it, and we actually ended up playing our first ever competitive game in the semi-final against Liepāja, which is a fairly famous club for their men's team that played in European competition. And more than 100 people came down to watch, which wouldn't be a bad crowd in many countries, professional, semi-professional level. But I think we lost 3-1, very respectable. And from there on, we took the team and we entered the league the following season.
Amazing, brilliant, yeah. Brilliant work, mate.
I mean, we should have set about 4 different podcasts. It's like Lord of the Rings, this. We should have had a podcast for every episode. However, we're going to have to leave Latvia behind and move on to the part of the story that it fascinates me. So, Matabeleland. Now, how on earth do you ever become involved in such an adventure? You know, was it? Did you feel like it was almost destined to be, or was it another of these, like you talked about with Latvia, another just series of coincidences that just kept moving and moving and moving you towards this almost inevitable adventure, if you like?
It's a combination of the two. I mean, me myself, I have this habit where I like to write down. I get a piece of paper and I just write down loads of ideas about things I'd like to do. And it could be something as relatively mediocre as going to watch athletics. I went to watch athletics this weekend, the European Grand Prix, and I've never actually been to one of them. But that's something I wrote down last year because I love athletics. I thought, well, I've never been to one. And on a much grander scale, I've written down that I want to be, let's say, an international football coach, or I want to play international football. You know, things that just seem impossible in themselves, but being an international football player doesn't mean that you're playing for England. You could be playing age 60 for whoever, you know. Having dreams and having things that you kind of aspire to do, and one of those things on the list was to be an international football manager in some shape or form. To be part of that setup. I think I was probably realistically imagining myself as a number two or a number three. I started looking into that, and I think you attract things by having that process. So kind of Conifer came into my world accidentally, and I think without Conifer, none of this would have happened. But through Conifer, I just became aware that maybe there was the possibility to coach one of these teams in Conifer. And I was looking, and something fell through. I was looking at coaching in the South Pacific, which is mentioned early in the book, and that fell through. I was a bit devastated, and then the general secretary of Conifer put me in touch with Matabeleland. Said, they got these lads down in Zimbabwe. Do you want to talk to them about potentially going out there and coaching? And that's how that process started.
For me, Zimbabwe, arguably not the most stable. Well, there's not many stable African nations, but certainly Zimbabwe seems, you know, an incredibly unstable African nation. How much fear and trepidation was there on your part in terms of this part of the adventure?
I love Africa. I've volunteered in Sierra Leone. I've done a hitchhiking thing, if that makes sense. I joined a lad called Bjorn Heidenstrom in 2010, and he hitchbiked from Europe all the way down to South Africa. And he was collecting shirts. He wanted to create the world's biggest football shirt. And I just happened to meet him through Riga United, actually. He was passing through Latvia, and I joined him in 2010, and I was on the road from Mombasa to South Africa. Some of it, probably about 15 days of it, on a bicycle. And I didn't have a single bad incident in terms of security during that time, and we had little accidents and things. But I really, you know, to be out in the middle of nowhere in Africa and realise it's not, if you take certain precautions as well, it's not as scary a place as you imagine. Fell in love with the place, and I'm not that intimidated by going to Africa as such, provided you follow certain, you don't go out walking around in the darkness by yourself 10 o'clock at night. But the difference with Zimbabwe was that there was this political uncertainty. There was the whole, you know, the anti-British, anti-white thing that went back a bit with Mugabe. And that was the only thing I was really particularly concerned about. I perhaps wondered whether Bulawayo, where I was going to be based, was anything like Johannesburg, because Johannesburg is not a city I feel particularly safe in. But those were probably the only two things that were really, before I went out, I guess.
Okay. Gary, I'm going to come to you. Obviously, like I say, you know, you're the brains and the founding father of our political football series. I mean, I'm sure you must have 101 questions and perhaps a potential episode in series 3 or 4 for the political football. But I'm sure you know you've got plenty of questions for Justin with regards to political overtures of this part of the journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, moving to Latvia and sort of getting involved with the setting up a football club there is one thing, and then moving to Matabele land, Zimbabwe, and the political upheavals going on there, and it was the dog days of the Mugabe regime and the political upheaval there. So, I mean, you mentioned that you never sort of felt unsafe and you were wise enough not to do the things that you shouldn't do in a lot of places, in lots of areas of the world. But did you ever get sort of disheartened by the political issues that were sort of, I mean, your book explains so many of these things happening, but that sort of dogged your progress as you're trying to, you know, move things forward for the team?
Yeah, it was a frustration, a limitation. It was, it never went away. We, you know, to put it in context, we were running a football team that some people thought that we were perhaps trying to cause or trying to make a political statement in Zimbabwe, perhaps looking at separatism for Matabele land. And that meant that we knew we were always watched. We knew that we were not necessarily going to be in favour with the government, especially with the Mugabe regime. I mean, there was a genocide committed in Matabele land on Mugabe's watch. So we were constantly, you know, conscious of that, constantly thinking that we can't, we've got to be very careful what we say, what we do, where we go, just not to get closed down, really, and not for there not to be a perception that we were up to no good, which we weren't. But it limited things because I had to keep such a low profile in the first couple of months I was there, you know, almost to the point where I was just almost hiding, frankly, when I wasn't on the football pitch coaching. As things deteriorated in Zimbabwe, I really, I had to keep my head down, really.
Yeah. One of the things in this part of the book, which sort of strikes me particularly, is the people you met there, and Ethel sounds like a fantastic character there.
One in a million. She's a wonderful lady. Absolutely took me under her wing, and old school lady. Brilliant company. Always looking out for me. Really gave me a home from home, and I'll be eternally grateful to that lady. There's not too many people I've met ever in my life a person as she is.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, part of the introduction, I'm going to come to Stephen, because Stephen will have his own opinions and perspectives of this particular character. But, you know, Stephen, Bruce Grobbelaar, you know, sometimes stories are so fantastic that they must be true. And for a character like Bruce Grobbelaar to pitch up in this narrative in the middle of this adventure is almost, you could actually say, yeah, I can believe that, because that was the sort of person he was.
Oh, completely. You know, we talk about a man who served in the what was then at the time the Rhodesian Army. You know, he's, you know, I remember stories of how, you know, he had to kill to survive. And so, yeah, and absolutely anything was possible with Bruce Grobler. But from where he came from, it just meant that, you know, all of these kind of outlandish stories or situations he'd seemingly end up in, they were nothing to him. It was kind of like, well, you know, I've seen far worse than this, and this is just kind of like nothing whatsoever. So, you know, that's the great thing about Bruce Grobler, is that nothing ever seemed implausible, you know, from a Liverpool supporting perspective. You know, I can remember being stood on the cop and watching him breakdance while there's an attack heading his way, and, you know, hanging off the crossbar and all sorts. And he just lived to entertain. You know, he never took it too seriously, and but it still somehow meant the world to him. And it was no surprise that to me that he was there. It just seemed natural.
I mean, how did, you know, for people who are listening, just, you know, Bruce Grobler's sort of, again, narrative in this story, you know, how did that come about?
He's from Zimbabwe, but he started his football career in Matabeleland. And I guess if you said to anyone who's the most famous Zimbabwean you could think of, it would probably be Bruce Grobler, or dare I say it, Robert Mugabe. And we were at the early stages where we needed to crowdfund a crazy amount of money, relatively speaking, to get the team to London and to create awareness and get people helping us. And, you know, we identified Bruce as someone that we'd love to get in. For those reasons, that he could perhaps help us, perhaps get people to take us more seriously, give us some good advice on how to do things. So I just contacted him. Just got found an email from Sasha at the General Secretary of CONIFA. Had an email for him, and just sent him off an email and explained what we were doing. Said, would you be interested in, you know, helping us as a brand ambassador? And he came back, I think the very next morning or the morning after, and said, I know all about your team, and I'd love to discuss the possibility of getting involved. And funny situation, I was in Latvia, he was in Canada, so we weren't about to meet for a cup of coffee that day. But yeah, a few weeks later, he said, look, I'm going to be in England in March, and I was going to be in England then as well, just before I was heading back to Zimbabwe for my second stint. And yeah, we ended up meeting on a M6 service station. So it was of course very surreal, but it was just I was coming down. I was coming down with an illness. I was super stressed. I was exhausted. I was driving. I was taking my mum. We were going up to Buxton to catch a play up there and have a bit of time away, and I stopped on the northbound on the M6, and I went across that bridge to Bruce on the other side. He was going south. And I said to my mum before I went, I said, if I can't get Bruce up on board here, I don't know what's going to happen, because I just feel like, I'm almost at the end of my tether with it. And went and met him. It was a very interesting situation when I met him. It felt very odd at the start. It was almost as if he was casing me out, that he wasn't sure whether he'll deal, which you can't blame him for with the stuff that's gone on in his life. But as you know, as we carried on talking, he changed, his mood changed, and he was very positive about coming involved. And I said to him, you know, could you possibly be the goalkeeper coach as well? And he said, yeah, I'll do that for you.
Wow. It's, you know, it's incredible. But I mean, obviously there was a lot of trials and tribulations. But looking back on your time, you know, we'll come to the World Cup in a sec. But looking back on your time, you know, in Zimbabwe, working with the team, the players, the people, you know, have you sort of got a best of time and worst of time from that particular period?
You mean being actually out in or do yeah. you mean the overall hot, including the World Cup?
Being out in Zimbabwe with the, you know, with the people, with the players, you know, just that particular part.
Well, I think the worst of time it's perhaps it's not when politics got to the. I mean, that was the most dramatic of times. But the worst of times, actually, which you talk about in the book, was a point at which we were playing in a tournament on a weekend, and this I'd been there a few weeks, so we sort of gained a bit of momentum with the team. And this particular weekend, I think we only had 10 lads turn up for this tournament we were playing in. And I'm not a big fan of playing weak teams. You know, we're preparing to play Connie for teams in a tournament the following summer. I don't want us playing pub teams. But Bisani and the lads have got us playing against a bunch of lawyers. And I don't think I'm being too cruel to these lads and say that most of them were quite overweight. And we got down there and this awful pitch, and it was actually a freezing cold day. I mean, it was about 8 degrees or something crazy. And these lads came out, and I thought, you've got to be joking, you know? This looks like a fourth division Sunday pub team, you know. And I thought, what are we doing playing them? And my lads are just—they're not up for it. They're waiting until the very last minute to change because it's so cold for them. And then Sani says to me, yeah, we've only got 10. One of the lads has got to go into town and run an errand, and we've only got 10 available. And he says, I'm one of them. So, you know, this is the FA president who's playing. He's in the starting 10. And, yeah, there's a discussion, should I play? Now, I'm thinking, the selfish part of me thinking, well, this would be great, you know, I'll get a game for Matabeleland here, but... I'm thinking, well, I can't do that. This is. I've got to manage this. This isn't good. I've got to. Every single one of these games we're using as an opportunity to develop. And the game started, and the lads were just shocking. They couldn't pass. They couldn't string 2-3 passes together. And these lads equalised. And I just remember this lad stepped up and took a penalty for them, and he must have been about 16 stone. And I thought, what am I doing here? I just thought, this is a disaster. Well, how on earth have I ended up out here? You know, that there's no way we can go to London and play against a load of lads that have played in Serie A and Serie C in Italy and all this stuff, you know. And so that was, yeah, that day was really a low point. In fact, there was a team meal afterwards, and I made my excuses and went home because I just couldn't. I didn't want to be around them because I thought they'd just see how down I was feeling with everything. So I think that's...
I mean, it's incredible. Like you say, all this talk about adventures and, you know, the things that have gone on and political and everything goes on, and still, in true football fashion, the biggest downer is a poor result. that's football. And that's how it can make you feel. If we move on then, you know, we've talked about Kanif a little, or you've talked about Kanif a little bit. If you could just, again, sort of put into context for us the Kanif World Cup and you know, and your sort of part within that and the team's part within that as well, just so we've got a bit of context for people who are listening.
Yeah, so Connie, for people who don't know, it's Confederation of Independent Football Associations, and it's you could say it's a body for non-FIFA affiliated teams, I think is probably the best way to describe it. And there's all kinds of categories of how you can enter that, and I won't start trying to explain what they all are, but you could be something as simple as a United Nations country, like Tuvalu, for example. They're not in FIFA, but they are a recognised country. And then you've got de facto states, and you've got, self-governing territories, tribal groups, language groups. So there's all kinds of definitions of how you can be in it. Goes back to 2013. I held the first tournament in 2014. This World Cup was the first that you had representation from all over the world. There was North America, Africa, Asia, Oceania, Europe, etc. And there's a qualifying campaign for it. So from the African members, Matabeleland had managed to qualify before I actually joined them, which was. Part of the job for me is I rather selfishly knew I was going to a World Cup, so it's not. I didn't get into a World Cup, but So yeah, the World Cup was going to be in London. Of course, we were never certain would it all go ahead at the time, because it was a massive gamble financially, and especially with an organisation that's just run voluntarily. But the team, yeah, we knew we were going out, and we knew we were representing Africa as one of the two teams going in from qualification. And then you're into the 16-team tournament, where we were drawn with Badania from Northern Italy, Zsekely Land from Romania, the Hungarian minorities in Romania, and Tuvalu, the country.
I mean, Gary, you know, this is, you know, tournaments like this, you know, are fantastic opportunities to grow the game.
Oh, definitely, and you know, and as Justin mentioned, you know, there's lots of regions of countries. I think Yorkshire actually a member of the of CONIFA as well. Am I right, Justin?
That's right. Yeah, although they weren't joined in time to take part.
But particularly with
sorry.
You qualify still, yeah?
I do, I qualify. Yeah, there we go. New life goal. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. Particularly with regard to the World Cup, just two sort of things, and they are linked. Firstly, about the shirt, which is the best football shirt I've ever seen in my life. I mean, fantastic shirt. And I know that was linked with also raising the funds that you had to get the guys over there and all the accommodation, that sort of thing as well. So so can you tell us a little bit about the shirt and the complications of raising the dosh?
Yeah, what happened with the shirt was when we were looking at ways to raise 30 grand, I said, well, look, one of the ways is we create a very cool, beautiful shirt and we try and sell it. But that's... That sounds very easy in practice, but you know, when you've got no supporters and no one knows about the team, you're not going to sell that many. And we were just through my CONIFA connections, I knew that there was an opportunity where the sponsors of the tournament, Paddy Power, were happy to provide the kits for one of the teams and do a little bit of marketing around it. So I knew about this, so I went and spoke to Paddy Power and I said, look, can we look at doing this for Matabele Land? And they were quite in favour. I said, well, the other thing is, I want it to, the same as you, want it to be a really nice kit, but we're going to try and sell it as a replica afterwards. Obviously, you can't be involved in that. But they said, all right, we're going to have a social media competition to design the shirt. So I thought, oh, this is fantastic, because obviously this is going to be great. Huge extra awareness for us. And so they ran the competition and basically asked people to put in designs for the home and away kits. And as you said, the kits are absolutely beautiful, both kits. It's hard to know which. I think I might prefer the away kit, actually, to the home kit. And thousands of people voted. I think we had several dozen designs. I mean, some of the designs that didn't even get in the shortlist were absolute beauties. They're better than most kits you see. I mean, I think it's the way forward for a lot of clubs. They should do something like this, actually, rather than paying some expensive designer to come in and do it for them. There's all that imagination out there of what people like. We did it, and from that we started selling the shirts and. Yeah, we managed to sell about 300, which is a stock we took. We sold out during the tournament. Which would have we were probably making about 15 quid a shirt. So, you know, we raised, let's say, five grand of what we needed from that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And the shirts, I'm not sure, was the first shirt the white with the yellow sleeves?
That's right.
The second kit one is, I mean, it just speaks of Africa to me as well. I mean, the design is fantastic. But one of the things I was going to ask you very briefly before Steve gets in is the book portrays that World Cup as being a friendly tournament, and the sort of relationship you had with other teams and other managers there. It seemed how football should be.
Yeah, look, with CONIFA, it's totally unpretentious. You're talking about places in the world where most of the teams, they don't get an opportunity. to play, unless they're in Conifer. A lot of people say that their country or their region shouldn't exist. So there's a certain solidarity, not in politics, but in circumstance. And the lads come, I mean, some of them have played or do play at a very high level, but you come together, you stay in the same hotel, which is absolutely fantastic. We got to London to the hotel there. And you go down to breakfast in the morning and all the teams are there. You walk, you're queuing up and there's lads with Punjab on the back of their tracksuits, North Cyprus, all this stuff. And it's an amazing thing. And everyone's saying hello to each other and mucking in. And you sit and have breakfast perhaps with another manager and with the referees and the media. And it's a wonderful thing. You know, I'd see my lads who'd never been out of Africa before, and they've been in London a few days, and they're sitting talking to journalists and different players from completely different parts of the world at breakfast. It's a wonderful thing.
Stephen, you know, your perceptions of Conifer, you know, and the World Cup, you know, I mean, like Gary's made a great point, you know, incredibly friendly. You know, does it take football back to its sort of, you know, its purest form? In terms of, you know, when you compare it to Russia and, you know, and what goes on in the FIFA World Cup, but also it's still football, it's still competitive, it's still a World Cup, it still has all those things that we love about football, but it just seems to be like we've just talked about there, almost in its purest form.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think the great thing about it, the way that Justin's just described it, is just how collective it all was, you know, all the teams together in the same hotel, you know, socialising, mixing, and that's just something you do not get in the professional game at the top levels anymore. You know, it's so far detached from, you know, the person on the street. It's completely untrue now, but, you know, I think the great thing about the Conifer tournament was that it just had that common touch. You know, it's something that you felt that you could just reach out and touch almost. And I think one of the great things was that it had an educational arm to it as well, is that people who were drawn into it and absorbed by it were seeing these names of places that possibly never heard of before. And they would sit up and take an interest in them and want to know more about these areas of the world that, you know, just seemed so invisible, you know, prior to this for so many people. And I think it just had so many different positive facets. There was no negativity to it. You know, we all lament, you know, modern football in some form or other. You know, we're a little bit jaded by it, a little bit cynical about huge parts of it, yet it still speaks to that inner child. Whereas this tournament and these teams, there just wasn't a negative aspect to it. And it was just so refreshing in that aspect.
Obviously, you know, before we leave the World Cup, Justin, you know, we're gonna have to get your comments on the team's performance overall. How would you assess the performance overall in the World Cup?
Overall, very, very happy. What happened for us was that the all but one game was on 3G, and our lads had never played on 3G before. And that's not because of lack of preparation. There are no 3G pitches in Zimbabwe. So that was a big disadvantage from us. And also the lads, it didn't have, many of them didn't have proper boots. So we went into the tournament. Bruce Grobbelaar managed to get us new boots for the whole team through New Balance in Liverpool. And it's, you know, to have 1.5 training sessions with new boots on 3G, and then to go in and play against the reigning European champions who've got Stankovic's, who played for Lazio in their start 11, for example. it's quite a big ask. but we started really well. We didn't pass as well as we would do on a terrible surface, ironically. But we had a bad period in the game, and then we looked like the wheels had come off and we were going to get absolutely hammered. We went 6-0 down, But then the lads, they got their heads together. We told them to, you know, really concentrate on just playing their simple game and taking advantage of their fitness. And they started it sounds a bit strange, 6-0 down, but we started running rings around for Daniel. We scored a fantastic goal. We had a breakaway a couple of minutes later. Could have been 6-2, 6-3. So we gained a lot of respect. And then we went in and played Zsekely Land. We've got lads playing Hungarian, Romanian second tier. And we were the better team for 25, 30 minutes from what I could understand of it. We nearly scored in the first 15 seconds. And then our keeper got sent off, and that was the end of the tournament for us, because then we couldn't. They had the experience to pick us off and to win that game. But after that, you know, we had our third group game. We knew we hadn't qualified for the knockout, but we said, look, we're going to do this. This is going to be our first ever win. We're playing Tuvalu. We're playing a country. So, you lads, you've got an opportunity here to put your... Yeah, we've had our first goal scorer, but you got your opportunity to say you were the first ever Matabeleland team to win a game in a major tournament and to beat a country, and that's what they did. And we beat Tuvalu 3-1. Incredible atmosphere, great performance. I mean, we played one of our worst periods in the second half in that, but we managed to hold them off and to score late on to make it 3-1. And then, you know, we had placement games after that, and effectively we won and draw the rest of those for the tournament. So we leave London with three wins, one draw and two defeats, which, you know, for a bunch of lads who've never played against teams of that level before in their lives, never been out of Africa before, never played on 3G, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, can I just jump in, Stu? Just a quick question. Modestly, Justin, you've missed a part out of this, because in, I think it was the last game, Matabeleland called up a veteran player to make his World Cup debut.
You mean Bruce Grobbelaar?
No. No.
What happened was... What had happened with the tournament is Ireland had withdrawn for reasons that would take too long to explain now. But so our actual game was replaced with a friendly match. So that's what happened. So we played Chagos Islands in a friendly, who are another CONIFA member. And I looked at it, and our players were all over. We were just in bits. We had so many injuries. We knew we had another game coming up, which we wanted to win the place at the end of the tournament. So I thought, well, I want to rest most of the first team lads. I thought it's a great opportunity now to bring Bruce Grobbelaar in. So I phoned Bruce up and said, you're starting. Love that. That's, yeah, one of my favourite things I've ever done, phone Bruce Grobbelaar up to tell him he's starting. I spoke to the Busani and Kanye, part of the management team, and said, look, I'd like to really give all our staff a game. Busani, Kanye, myself, Bruce Grobbelaar and Matt Perella, the other goalkeeper coach who I brought over from the States. So we all had a game, yeah, and we won. And I gave myself the last 9 minutes, which wasn't too long, but I was absolutely made up. Yeah, when I walked on the pitch there and be on the pitch at the end when we won the game and clapping the crowd. It was just an absolutely incredible experience and something you're never ever going to forget, you know.
When I read that, I mean, it's certainly, I think it's my favourite part of the book. And I mean, there's many parts of the book that make you sort of the feel-good factor. But that, when you read that at the end of that game and, you know, the camaraderie there, I mean, that must have been a fantastic moment in your life.
Yeah, it was, and it goes back to what I said earlier about you write things down, and it's amazing. You create these ideas, you put them out to the universe, and sometimes they happen. You know, if I thought I was ever going to play international football, I thought it was going to happen when I was 18 or 19, not when I was 47. it's you never know what's going to happen in life, and you need to dream big. And it just that came along, and yeah, it's. it's one of those things to say, I think I say in the book, you know, I woke up on that morning and said, you know, this is the moment I've been waiting for all my life in many ways. No, not my wedding day, but, you know, my international debut.
Brilliant. As always with these, you know, time sort of runs away with us, and you know, we're already an hour in, but I would like just to get, because obviously, you know, you've done some work at the World Cup in Russia last summer, and I was, you know, I just really sort of wanted your, you know, you're in a perfect position to sort of compare and contrast, you know, the two different tournaments. But you know, obviously, I personally got to see a lot of obviously what the media wants us to see. But obviously, somebody who was there and working there, what were your perceptions, Justin, of the World Cup last summer in Russia?
I went there and it was really fundamentally a holiday, and I wasn't going to watch that much football. I've been to Russia before, but Russia's lovely in the summer, and I just was looking forward to watching a lot of games, really, in the cities, in the fan zones and in the pubs and stuff. But I got to Russia, and it just from the first moment I arrived in Moscow, the atmosphere was just unbelievable. And it was so well organised. You know, you got into Moscow and they were showing the games live on the metro, and there were people everywhere showing you where to go, and there was free transport, and it was just absolutely fantastic. And just from day one all the way through to the end of the tournament, it just had a very, very special feeling that it's a football country, and the people understand the game, and they were very grateful for the tournament being there. So, you know, it's good to be in a country for a World Cup where people actually understand the game and they have a passion for the game. And they're also, they're actually wanting foreign visitors to be there, because, you know, there's a lot of false impressions of the Russians. They're very opening. They want people to visit their country. And it was a very special time. Of course, England doing well was the cherry on the cake.
It always helps, doesn't it? I mean, Gary and Stephen, you know, before we let Justin go, I'm sure he's got another adventure to go on, even just tonight. But before we let him go, you know, Gary, you know, have you got another question?
I just wonder what's next. The reason I say that is because, you know, this is a book about a guy who's been to 125 different countries, 6 World Cups and European Championships, moved to Latvia, founded a football club there, and then founded a women's club there as well, joined Canova, nearly went to the South Pacific coaching, ended up in Matabele land, coaching there, and all the trials and tribulations about raising money there, took a team to the World Cup, a World Cup tournament, made his debut, got Bruce Grobbelaar involved and played alongside Bruce Grobbelaar with the same team, developed a kit and raised loads of money, and from sort of being sort of linked on Twitter over the past few months, he become such a celebrity as well, been interviewed by so many different world media. I mean, I don't know what you can do next, Justin. It's a great story. I mean, I'm not even going to top it, mate.
Oh, it's very kind of you. I mean, I'm actually just living with my mum at the moment in Leicestershire.
Well, that tops it.
Yeah. I'm not exactly...
Just to round it off, I mean, I think the first time we tried to contact you, you were on holiday with your mother in Peru or somewhere?
Colombia. Yeah.
Colombia. Yeah, I mean,
Colombia.
I used to take my mum to Butlins.
Why that? I mean, my mum hadn't been that well, and I really, in a way, I wanted to take her somewhere I suspected would be very beautiful, but I wanted to sort of scare her almost, that she forgot about her. Not feeling well, and we went to Colombia, and she came back from the holiday feeling better than she's felt in a couple of years, and she said it was the best place she's ever been. So, you know, it was an amazing experience, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, so what's next? Where are you going to top what you've done so far? I mean, you could take over England and win the World Cup for England, but. I'm not sure how I was going to top it, mate.
I'm not sure how I'd work with your top level players. I'm not sure they take me too seriously, so I'm not sure. I think those are hard jobs in their own way, psychologically, with who you've got to deal with. I'm going to go to Brazil this summer to the Copa America to watch that, and hopefully do some work for somebody. I'm trying to find somebody that wants me to cover the Copa for them. And after that, I'm looking for a new adventure in football, possibly with CONIFA. We've got next World Cup in Somaliland the following summer. So perhaps take a team to that tournament. I think playing a tournament in Africa is fairly dramatic as well. And if not, then perhaps going somewhere in the world that needs a bit of development in football, but also comes with a bit of an adventure.
Yeah, more power to you, mate. Yeah. More power to you.
Stephen, any sort of final questions or thoughts for Justin?
Yeah, I'd just go back to kind of like that. It's almost like a brilliant kind of missionary purpose to the book, which is brilliant. I'm almost like half expecting a Dr. Livingstone moment, you know, where someone appears through the reeds and yeah. But going back to Riga, you know, helping form a football club, can you see in 100 years that a street will be named after you in Riga?
No.
In short.
Yeah. It won't be for the football. could be for the original reasons for going there. I don't see that.
Brilliant stuff. Brilliant stuff.
Well, like I say, you know, we're sort of well over there already. Justin, you know, we could have had multiple episodes on the podcast about the life and times. But certainly anybody who's listened to this, you know, I absolutely, and Gary said it right at the beginning, you know, implore you to buy, you know, One Football, No Nets. It is the most extraordinary football story that I think I've ever read, and like Stephen said earlier as well, you know, it transcends football as well. It goes beyond. It's not just a football book. You know, it is the most incredible tale, and all of it, you know, is true. Thank you so much for your time, you know, and spending time with us.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's really been a pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Trust me, the pleasure is all ours. Gary, another fascinating chat.
Definitely. I mean, I can only echo what you said about imploring people to buy the book. If you like football, you'll love this. If you like adventure, you'll love this. If you like stories of the extraordinary, you'll like this. I mean, it's a fantastic book, and it's been a joy talking with Justin about it.
And Stephen, do you probably just feel as inadequate as I do with what I've done with my life so far?
yeah, just a little bit. But no, that has been absolutely spectacular. And really, it's... I'd implore anyone who does buy this book to pass it on to someone else who's maybe not a football fan, because they'll just love it for its sheer sense of adventure.
Brilliant. Well, all that's left really is for me to thank the people who have listened to another edition of the Centre Circle with the Lob podcast at These Football Times. And please be sure to join us again, where hopefully we will have another just as interesting guest as we had this time round. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.